This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. But today I'm a very nervous Brian Bellow. You know, guys, I'm supposed to spend my time thinking about history, talking about the past, but I can't stop looking at the present. It seems to me that we have a real crisis on our hands with this climate thing. I mean, all you got to do is turn on the television, and it looks like the sky really is falling.
Forecasters are predicting no relief from the haze or the heat.
Warmer
this
winter temperatures and stronger winds.
Snow in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Warmest since records began 120 years ago.
Extreme weather year all over
Carbon
the globe.
Carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. grew by 18% between 1990
and... Ice caps melting, extinctions as ecosystems scatter, massive drought looming
this
in the U.S.
This is absolutely not happening due to natural causes.
You see what I'm talking about?
Brian, I'm disappointed in you.
It's true, Ed. He's acting as if we haven't seen all this before. It's really not very historian-like of him.
Come on, guys. Will you drop the history
so
stuff
surprised.
For just a second? Have you looked at those charts of carbon dioxide levels and how much they've risen over the past few decades? I mean, it's terrifying. We're talking about right here, right now. I really don't understand how history can help us out on this one.
Well, you got to look at it this way. What we're trying to figure out is not so much the climate, since we're not climatologists, but they study this with history, right? They go back and look at these tree rings and all. That's how we know there is a crisis. But what can plain old historians do? Well, we can think about how people have thought about environmental crisis, mm-hmm. right? Are there times that people have really freaked out about what's happening? I bet that there have been times. I bet that people have always had some kind of anxiety about the environment.
Well, I can't wait for you guys to convince me on this one.
Each week on the show, we rip a topic from the headlines and explore its historical context. This week, the history of environmental crisis. But first, let's let that nice woman tell our listeners who we are.
Progeny of the Puritans, friend to the founders. A man of big ideas, he can overturn orthodoxy with his pinky finger. It's 18th century guy, Mr. Peter Onuf.
Hey, Mr. Jefferson, let's pursue some happiness.
From the hills of Tennessee, his war is civil, and so is his manner. 19th century guy, Mr. Edward Ayres.
Y'all make a fine argument, but I respectfully disagree.
Baby, you can drive my car.
Hailing from the Florida swamps, he has a greater command of your own past than you do. That's 20th century guy, Mr. Brian Bellow.
Step on the gas and crank the AC.
Beep, 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 yeah.
So as a 20th century guy, I want to start this off by asking you, Peter, our 18th century guy, I want to ask you how people thought about nature back in your period. I mean, it strikes me that back then they didn't worry about what they were doing to nature, but they were pretty concerned about what nature was about ready to do to them. In fact, they were pretty scared of nature, weren't they?
Absolutely. Nature was wilderness, dangerous, and the idea that nature, land, resources would run out is absolutely unthinkable to somebody of Thomas Jefferson's generation. Thomas Jefferson told us, and whatever he says goes on this program, we have land enough for the thousandth to the thousandth generation. That's what he told his fellow Americans in his inaugural address, 4th of March, 1801.
Yeah, but yet we know by the end of the 1800s, people were worried about running out of forests. They were worried about streams not supplying the water they need to.
We don't have to wait until the end of the 19th century. Let's talk about Thomas Jefferson's own Virginia. He was very much aware, as everyone else was as well, that they were stripping all the nutrients out of the soil with this evil sot weed of tobacco. And you could argue that the first environmental crisis of the United States was right here in Virginia, right under Thomas Jefferson's feet.
Well, where do you think Horace Greeley got this idea about going west, young man? It's because of resource stripping in the east.
Yeah.
And besides, the moment has passed in the east for being agricultural. We got to move into the next phase.
Okay.
We
got to
be manufacturing. We got to have big cities.
Okay, Mr. Smarty Pants.
Yeah.
What happens?
You talking about me or Jefferson?
You.
Okay.
What happens when we can no longer move west? I mean, what happens when we fill out
the
continent?
Well, that's the whole notion of frontier, man.
Okay, but
that is another frontier.
But they didn't always just leave. There was some kind of notion, some kind of principle that they had to take care of the land, that they had to be good stewards.
The way early Americans would look at the problem
is
that people needed to have free access to this boundless supply of land. The big problem in the old world was that there was too little land. But I will say this, Jefferson believed that there was a notion of stewardship, and it was to pass on opportunity for free access to the land from generation to generation. So tell Jefferson, hey, there isn't enough for thousands of generations, and Jefferson would be listening to you.
And he might even, although we think of him as Mr. Small Government, he might even be willing to embrace Teddy Roosevelt and the conservationists with the notion that maybe it's the government's obligation, not that the government wasn't important in, you know, clearing the land, selling the land and all of that. But what happened?
Taking the land.
Look, what this is really about is getting to my century.
I started to say, I want to move.
You haven't mentioned the 20th century once.
We're not
it's
there yet.
It's an overrated century, Brian. Okay, we're making Jefferson green just for the purposes of conversation, that this notion of stewardship, and for Brian, that implies a strong role for government. Of course, I just suggested.
Not necessarily, yeah, but
because
I do
there
think
are
that
market-based solutions that have been offered by people from the right.
Government
policies in the National Forest, for instance, that have put a premium on premature exploitation of resources by building roads, giving lumber companies privileged access to lands that would otherwise be unspoiled. The historic role of government is to degrade the environment.
You know, what's interesting is that it's not like we followed one path. And I think we've had conservation very early on. And even today, you can open an ad in a newspaper and it says, if the government would just let us at it, there's all this untapped coal and natural gas and oil. If we weren't just so sissy about some little organisms and little minnows and owls and stuff, we could get at it. But the point is that, and it goes back to your opening question, Brian, what do historians have to add to this? And what we have to add to it is the notion that this is a perpetual, perennial human conversation. Oh my God, are we using up all this stuff? You know, you think about peoples before the Europeans arrived here, lived in North America, moved around.
I would say, though, that the scale of our conversation has changed. We move from a time in the 17th and 18th century in the earliest settlements in America when people lived in very small worlds.
They but what were difference do they make? They,
well,
they
I'll tell you what. What we're worried about now is the whole thing, and that's why that business about globalization, thinking of the planet as an interdependent whole, that's new.
Well, Peter, I don't know if the scale has changed, but the length of our conversation has changed.
No, talk about an inexhaustible resource. We could go on forever.
I want to get to those callers, and I hope that we're going to explore with those callers some of the very themes that we've begun to talk about here. So let's go to the phone. Peter, I understand we have a caller waiting for us.
We do indeed, Brian. We've got Ron from Washington, D.C. Ron, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Great to be with you all. I'm fine.
And I think you've got nature on your mind.
I do. Part of what I'm concerned about or interested in is sort of the history, if you will, of environmental crises. When I was a kid back in college, of course, I was taught things like the population bomb by my professors or the limits to growth or Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the population bomb said that that hundreds of millions of people were going to starve to death in the 1970s, despite anything we could do now. Rachel Carson was saying, you know, that we're going to have massive cancer epidemics because of our exposure to pesticides. And limits to growth were supposed to be completely out of oil by the mid-1990s.
Yeah.
And then even in the late 1970s, the global report to the president, you know, said that a quarter of all species will be dead by the year 2000. You know, right now, of course, we have a lot of sincere people saying, once again, like, you know, Vice President Al Gore, we're in the middle of an environmental crisis.
Well, you know, we've always been in the middle of an environmental crisis. And I'd have to say, going back to the earliest periods of American history, that it's all relative to what any society and community needs in order to sustain itself. Let me give you one earlier environmental crisis, and that would be deforestation in the Northeast. That is, by 1800, there was very little accessible firewood because of the wasteful exhaustion of resources. And there was a real concern. You look at New England now, and it's a very pretty place, a lot of trees. You fly over it, and you say, whoa, this is natural. Well, New England, at least southern New England, had very few trees.
Ron, I detect that you have some skepticism about these predictions of crisis. I just want to note—
Just because they didn't come true?
I just want to note that even though none of them came to pass, one of the reasons that they didn't come to pass in some instances is that we reacted and responded as a society, often with government action. Let's take the crisis of deforestation in my century, the 20th century, okay? Well, we set up national forests. We put 200 million acres under federal management. And yes, we still use those trees today. It's not that we don't cut them. But in fact, we changed our entire policy vis-a-vis forests. We did that to reduce the threat of forest fires. And many would argue that one of the reasons that we haven't had complete deforestation is that we actually did something in response to the
perceived crisis. Yeah, we deforested the rest of the world.
But I like my dining room table, Peter.
With due respect with regard to the deforestation in the United States essentially stopped, as I understand it, around 1920, and something like 80% of the wood we use today comes from private lands, not from the national lands that have been set aside.
No, that's absolutely right, but many of those largest forest-based products companies like Weyerhaeuser, changed their practices to crop rotation, to selective forestation. And that was in part through the government imploring them to do that. In part, the government learned quite a bit from large corporations like Weyerhaeuser. My point is that we did change our practices.
Yeah, and I'd like to broaden that a little bit. This is Ed. It's not just the government, Brian.
Oh, yes, it is, Ed.
To go back to the original point, I thought you were going to say that if they had not made these alarming arguments, nobody, including the market, would have paid attention to them.
Well,
right?
And you're making my point better than me.
Okay, well, you're welcome then. Rachel Carson makes her point, and then the market recognizes, gosh, we just can't keep pumping out DDT. We're going to have to find alternatives to this and so forth. And so you could argue that people almost have to exaggerate to get the attention of the media, and it doesn't really matter if it's true or not.
Saying that it's okay to lie for justice?
No, well, that's a good point.
Exaggerate.
No.
Accentuate.
I'd say that they don't know they're lying. They're extrapolating in a straight line from if things don't change.
Right.
But by the very nature of bringing it to people's attention, things do begin to change. So,
well, Ron, the only people you can really trust are historians. We never lie. Thanks for your call.
Or exaggerate. You're with us at Backstory. We're the American History Guys. I'm Brian Ballow, your guide to the 20th century.
And I'm Ed Ayers, your humble servant of the 19th century.
And I'm Peter Onuf, master of everything else.
We're talking about environmental crisis, past and present.
We got another caller on the line. It's Josh from Philadelphia, PA. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
And what you got on your mind today?
The question is, in the sort of environmental catastrophe scenarios, I can't help but think of earlier sort of American catastrophe scenarios that belong not to the realm of ecology, but belong to the realm of religion.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about earlier times where people were worried about the end of the world.
Yeah.
So my first question,
are not just earlier times, Josh.
Right.
You've noticed.
Right. So the first question is, if we might see, you know, precursors in this kind of thinking in religious thought, when is the first sort of purely ecological articulation? So when people are thinking of the end times as being not in a sort of Christian timeline, but in a geological or ecological one.
I think your point about secularization is good in a way. I think geology had a lot to do with it. That is, you couldn't think in these kind of short time frames about what might happen within three or four years.
I'm a little disappointed, Peter, that you didn't seize on this to focus on Malthus.
Well, here's your chance.
Yeah.
Let me tell you
about Malthus. Okay.
Thomas.
Malthus, you know, Tom Malthus, who is one of the founders of what we now call classical economics, and his great contribution to the really dismal science, and it was Malthus who made it as dismal as possible, was that
when
the growth
was this,
of population,
where was this?
Late 18th, early 19th century in Britain, it was Malthus who introduced the idea of population outstripping resources.
Right.
And that geometric growth of population and resources could only increase incrementally.
Right.
And that's really a lot of American sense of environmental possibility and the end of the earth, as it were, is an exaggerated sense of limitless space and resources, that American society was an exception to the Malthusian rule.
So Josh, does that sound like the answer to your question?
Yeah, that's a good answer to the question, and it leaves me in the quandary of the second question, which is, as someone who has environmental commitment, who's convinced that something exceptional is going on here, how can I, without having to read a lot of hard science, how can we respond to this charge that what's going on with environmental concern on the left is merely another iteration of this kind of apocalyptic thinking? Does history as a discipline offer us any kind of tools with which to refute those charges?
That is a super question, and it just occurs to me the way to think about it is that history teaches us to think about whole systems. And we used to think about great men changing history and the white man hero idea. But more and more we think about remote implications, about how everything's tied together. And it's this sense of connectedness which makes us aware of the world as subject to common influences.
I think that's brilliant, Peter. This is Ed. That the other insight that I think historians are increasingly struck by, you're right, the system, but it's also what makes historians different from, say, sociologists or other social scientists, is we focus on the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
So the feedback loop on something happening. Now, you talk about the butterfly effect, the butterfly in China.
Right, right.
But it's also the feedback loop of human actions, right? So we talk about Rachel Carson doing something. Well, it wasn't so much the carcinogens necessarily, but
right.
What in fact happened was, in many ways, the birth of the modern environmentalist movement.
Yeah.
And Josh, I just have a simpler answer to your question, which is sometimes historians decide that now actually is now. And that there are moments when people step up and act, and this is what leads to historical change, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, now is also time for us to end this call.
Josh, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, guys.
And we have another caller. I don't know why they keep calling, but we love it. And this is Donna, who lives nearby, and she should know better. Donna, you're from our fair city of Charlottesville.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling.
Well, since I'm calling from Charlottesville, and since this is, of course, the home of Mr. Jefferson.
Ooh, you're hitting close to home here.
Exactly. Well, I have a question about the way we think of ourselves as an American people. And the tension, it seems to me, there's always been between the Jeffersonian ideal of an agrarian society, the importance of the virgin land and all of that, and the reality of commercial development.
Yeah.
And there's always been that incredible tension. And I wondered if you could speak to that notion.
Yeah, I'd love to. Donna, you have just unleashed a volcano.
Uh-oh.
I have a stake in Mr. Jefferson. And that is this notion that Jefferson is a great natural steward and has a sense of agrarian connectedness to the land and so forth. That's a great, great myth in American history. Let me just say this. Jefferson thought that the Ohio River was the most beautiful river on earth, and he had never seen it. When he said it was beautiful, he meant it was beautiful in its capacity for development. It was the central highway of mid-America. And so what he imagined was a nation of farmers, commercial farmers, and ultimately manufacturers. He was imagining a world within America.
So, Peter, are you telling us that Jefferson envisioned ConAgra?
No, I mean, he couldn't deal with large-scale stuff like that. Yeah, but the idea of Jefferson hugging trees, no.
Donna, this is Brian. I have to ask you if your world has been shattered by Peter. So many others.
Tell me, come on.
Yes.
Thank you, Donna.
I'm weeping. No, actually, I suspected as much about Jefferson,
yeah.
Alas. But also, I mean, and it seems to have gone on throughout the history. I mean, the whole opening of the West.
Yeah, sure.
The Homestead Act and railroads, which was kind of under this guise of the small farmer going out. And, of course, the country just gave all this land to the railroads. And all these people went out there, of course, and went bust.
This is Brian Dunn, and I'll argue they didn't exactly give it to the railroads. It was part of these grants to the railroads.
And yeah,
the railroads,
it was corruption, right?
The railroads were supposed to use it, sell it into the free market, and one might argue that it turned out to be not a totally inefficient way to distribute that land to millions of Americans.
Right, but they also, the railroads were determined, of course, they needed settlers, or else the railroads were sort of meaningless.
They had a great stake in getting settlers out there, but a lot of them.
And so they sold what, you know, much of the West, which was totally worthless, which was, you know, supposedly before then the Great American Desert, as being this paradise of endless rain and whatever. And so it was all done under this guise of this sort of Jeffersonian dream of the small farmers going out there. And I can only imagine the amount of bribery that went on in the halls of Congress to get all these lands in private hands.
That's the political process, right, Brian?
I couldn't agree more.
And so therefore I have to disagree, only in the sense that you could argue that every suburban lawn is a Jeffersonian vision, that the idea of independence on your own land is what the railroads were selling, it's what Jefferson was selling.
Well, I have to say also that every suburban lawn is subsidized by the federal government. It's subsidized by the highways the federal government built to bring people out there. I'm simply saying that the political system has been undergirding expansion and development for some time, and it continues to
be. You know, you've been a great caller, Donna, but you came on with false pretenses. I thought I was going to rock your world, and it turns out you knew all this stuff.
Well, no, you did rock my world.
I was looking for that.
I have to live in Charlottesville knowing this. I mean, this is very tough.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, Donna.
Thank you, Donna.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about environmental crises throughout American history. What does the past have to teach us about our current state of affairs? Next up, we got Mike on the line from Rockville, Maryland. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I wanted to ask a question sort of as one historian to a bunch of historians.
Whoa, who is this guy?
I'm not a ringer, believe it.
This is very threatening, Mike, but carry on.
Well, I do an awful lot of historical research into those old Progressive Era reports that you find in the city halls and state libraries.
They're terrific, aren't they?
They really are. And apropos of that, I wanted to ask you guys if you also might find them to be, in a sense, almost an inspiration. You know, I've been thinking an awful lot lately about coalition building against global warming, and maybe there's some lessons from previous generations, including these wonderful populists and progressives from more than 100 years ago.
Well, Mike, this is Brian again. And first of all, just on the inspiration thing, I was actually working in the old Tweed Courthouse in Manhattan. This was long before I went to graduate school in history. And not being the best employee in the world, I used to wander about the old Tweed Courthouse, and I kept rummaging through these old files. And it was rummaging through some of those files that actually got me interested in being an historian.
So you guys both really love these old...
on inspiration.
But who were these guys, the progressives?
Well, Peter, the progressives were just about everybody who believed in turning to first state and local government, eventually the federal government, to solve some of the pressing problems that they faced at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s. In fact, the Progressive Era was the first time where there was mass mobilization to put in place policies that actually would help conserve the forest, that would protect some of our key watersheds. And in fact, when you think about America's traditional opposition to strong government action, it's really quite amazing that hundreds of millions of acres were taken out of regular productive use and put into the national forests.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the tools that the progressives developed, and one of the ones you see so often in the reports is this notion of publishing the fish kill or issuing the awful word about how, you know, a whole herd of cows died from fumes next to a plant or a...
Mike, you're just inspiring me so much because, you put your finger on the essence of progressivism, which was a tremendous belief in publicity. And they really genuinely believed that the key to making social and political change was creating a public opinion that would support the kinds of programs
getting
that they
politicians
advocated.
Out of smoke-filled rooms.
That's right. No, that's
right.
Exactly
smoking
right,
bans.
Yeah, I guess I'm struck by if the parallel is today, which is the way that Mike phrased this.
Why do you always listen to our callers' questions so carefully?
I'm struck today about the extent to which it's become really privatized. You know, everybody's recycling on their own, and it's sort of what the little kid's going to make a difference. It's almost become kind of a spiritual movement rather than one of bureaucracies and organizations, it strikes me.
Okay, but why is that such a bad thing?
I'm not saying it's bad.
That people have imbibed this as individuals. Isn't that how we do things here in the United States?
Yeah, I'm playing it off against the progressive era, which suggested a sort of organized and quasi-political approach to it.
So collective action.
Yeah,
the thing that strikes me, you know, I go into these places, these city halls, and the term that always hits me, almost like defining the identity of that collective effort, these folks a lot of times called themselves sanitarians.
You know, there's a reason they call themselves sanitarians, and that's because what got this whole concern about environment going was concern about sanitation. Americans did understand that if you didn't have sanitary public water supplies and sanitation, then that you couldn't survive just as individuals.
And now this is Ed arguing directly against himself to say that...
I knew we could trick him into this.
I'm so easily distracted. Go back to Mike's fundamental point about the continuities of this first movement 150 years ago in our own time. And if you think about the New York Times Fresh Air Fund, now the basic premise of that is if we could just get these city kids out into fresh air, into the country, that they will be ennobled and made more healthy. Even though now you're more likely to be healthy in a city than living where there's poor health care out in the countryside, it still seems transparently obvious to us that the Fresh Air Fund, taking people out to farms, is actually a restorative method. So there's deep echoes, I think, of the progressive era impulse.
Yeah, and Mike, now I want to argue in favor of Ed, since he's argued against himself. and that is when Americans started having the wherewithal and also the transportation, which was really encouraged, especially by the highway building after World War II, they began moving out of cities as quickly as they could. And so I think that when Americans are forced to work collectively, they will. But as soon as they can begin to engineer those kind of more individualistic responses, they'll also do that. And I find that quite sad, actually.
This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Oh, and, you're quite welcome. And
steal one of those reports for me.
Great.
Well, for sure.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.
Looks like we have time for one more call, guys. And I believe it's Nancy from Santa Clara, California.
Hi.
How are you, Nancy?
Pretty good. How are you?
Yeah. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was really interested in this whole topic and how have Americans conceived our, you know, our proper role in nature. And I'm particularly interested in this and the role that gender has played in this. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, there's a prominent book from about 10 years ago that I think of as called The Lay of the Land. It referred to nature as imagined by men as feminine, as something there to be conquered.
To penetrate.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think as soon as you introduce the notion of domestication, of taming, and of fertility, and that is the earth gives, but it has to be properly cultivated.
It's fruitful.
Yeah, it's fruitful. Right. So, I mean, I think there is a strong gender dimension to our understandings of nature.
And I really have a problem with that. I mean, to me, this is a sort of a continuing way of actually devaluing women and so forth.
No, I think you're right.
It's frustration for what these ideas about mother nature and so forth do to women, but also what they do to nature.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that nature deserves more respect, that it shouldn't be anthropomorphized in any way,
right.
That nature is not a him or a her, it's nature.
Well, Nancy, let me give you a hard time. Let me suggest that gender enables people to imagine connections with nature. And if we don't imagine those connections, we can't be good stewards. In other words, you're suggesting that nature has to be seen as something utterly other.
No, I'm not saying it's something utterly other, but I don't even like the term, you know, steward and stewardship. Stewardship sort of assumes that we are stewards over nature.
Right.
So I'm not saying nature as an other, but more as a valued partner where there isn't this sort of hierarchy that's involved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Talking about partner elevates humans to a role we probably don't really deserve. We're just a piece of nature.
Oh, no, but I think that I always get frustrated. People talk about nature and humans as if people are not part of nature.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I think we're vociferously agreeing with
each
other.
Yeah, we just want to know how to conceptualize that. That's our big challenge, and language that enables us to understand that connection.
Well, I guess I'm really better at coming up with language that I don't like than what I do.
We are too.
I like the partnership idea very much. I don't like stewardship. I don't like, you know, Mother Nature, Father Time, you know, those kinds of things.
How about Gaia, the whole notion of Earth as a throbbing organism, that we're all part of it?
Well, I guess I go more with the notion of web. A web of life and interconnectedness.
Yeah.
That works for me.
We like that.
Okay.
And thanks a lot.
Well, problem solved. That was easy.
We have solved the problem, and everybody out there in Radio Land has got the solution. Thank you so much, Nancy,
that
call.
Thanks for the show. I'm really happy it's going on here. It's great.
Great.
Thanks.
Whoa, guys, that shook me up a little bit. How about you, Ed?
That was really interesting. I thought just sort of come at us and say the fundamental language that you're using to talk about this is, you got to think about it. It's in yikes.
Yeah, but we need some language, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, it just shows you how hard it is to imagine things without using
gender. Well, you know, the
gender.
Old response to nature as sacred is, in fact, awed silence. I think our listeners out there could use some awed silence.
But not on our show.
We have to take another break. But before we do, let me remind you that future episodes of Backstory are taking shape on our website as I speak. And we want your input. Visit us at backstoryradio.org.
And when we get back, we go back to nature right here in our very own Blue Ridge Mountains.
Don't go away.